beard and mustache, which I was still getting used to, Matthew looked even more forbidding. But I didn't want to argue with him. "Sorry," I said quickly before changing the subject. "Next week we're going to mix up a fresh batch of Prima Materia. That has mercury in it, but I promise not to touch it. Mary wants to see if it will putrefy into the alchemical toad by the end of January."
"That sounds like a festive start to the new year," Matthew said, settling the cloak over my shoulders.
"What were you looking at?"
I peered out the windows. "Someone's building a bonfire across the river for New Year's Eve. Every time they send the wagon for fresh wood, the local residents filch what's already there. The pile gets smaller by the hour. It's like watching Penelope ply her needle."
"Mary said no one will be working tomorrow. Oh, and be sure to tell Francoise to buy extra manchet. That's bread, right? And to soak it in milk and honey to make it soft again for Saturday's breakfast."
It was Elizabethan French toast in all but name.
I think Mary's worried I might go hungry in a house run by vampires.
"Lady Pembroke has a don't ask, don't tell policy when it comes to creatures and their habits," Matthew observed.
"She certainly never mentioned what happened to her shoes," I said thoughtfully.
"Mary Sidney survives as her mother did, by turning a blind eye to every inconvenient truth. The women in the Dudley family have had to do so."
"Dudley?"
I frowned.
That was a family of notorious troublemakers. Nothing at all like the mild-mannered Mary.
"Lady Pembroke's mother was Mary Dudley, a friend of Her Majesty and sister to the Queen's favorite, Robert."
Matthew's mouth twisted.
"She was brilliant, just like her daughter. Mary Dudley filled her head with ideas so there was no room in it for knowledge of her father's treason or her brother's missteps. When she caught smallpox from our blessed sovereign. Mary Dudley never acknowledged that both the Queen and her own husband thereafter preferred the company of others rather than face her disfigurement."
I stopped, shocked.
"What happened to her?"
"She died alone and embittered, like most Dudley women before her. Her greatest triumph was marrying off her 15-year-old namesake to the 40-year-old Earl of Pembroke."
"Mary Sidney was a bride at 15?
"The shrewd, vibrant woman ran an enormous household, reared a pack of energetic children, and was devoted to her alchemical experiments, all with no apparent effort. Now I understood how. Lady Pembroke was younger than me by a few years, but by the age of 30 she'd been juggling these responsibilities for half her life."
"Yes. But Mary's mother provided her all the tools necessary for her survival. Iron discipline, a deep sense of duty, the best schooling money could buy, a love of poetry, and her passion for alchemy."
I touched my bodice, thinking of the life growing within me. What tools would he need to survive in the world? We talked about chemistry on our way home. Matthew explained that the crystals that Mary brooded over like a hen were oxidized iron ore, and that she would later distill them in a flask to make sulfuric acid. I'd always been more interested in the symbolism of alchemy than in its practical aspects, but my afternoon with the Countess of Pembroke had shown me how intriguing the links between the two might be. Soon we were safely inside the Heart and Crown, and I was sipping a warm tisane made from mint and lemon balm. It turned out the Elizabethans did have teas, but they were all herbal. I was chattering on about Mary when I noticed Matthew smile.
"What's so funny?"
"I haven't seen you like this before," he commented.
"Like what?"
"So animated. Full of questions and reports of what you've been doing and all the plans you and Mary have for next week."
"I like being a student again," I confessed. It was difficult at first, not to have all the answers. Over the years, I've forgotten how much fun it is to have nothing but questions.
"And you feel free here, in a way that you didn't in Oxford. Secrets are a lonely business."
Matthew's eyes were sympathetic as his fingers moved along my jaw.
"I was never lonely."
"Yes, you were. I think you still are," he said softly.
Before I could shape a response, Matthew had me out of my seat and was backing us toward the wall by the fireplace.
"P. Pierre, who was nowhere to be seen only moments before, appeared at the threshold. Then a knock sounded. Matthew's shoulder muscles bunched, and a dagger flashed at his thigh. When he nodded, Pierre stepped out onto the landing and flung open the door.
"We have a message from Father Hubbard."
Two male vampires stood there, both dressed in expensive clothes that were beyond the reach of most messengers. Neither was more than 15. I'd never seen a teenage vampire, and had always imagined there must be prohibitions against it.
"Master Royden?"
The taller of the two vampires tugged at the tip of his nose and studied Matthew with eyes the color of indigo. Those eyes moved from Matthew to me, and my skin smarted from the cold.
"Mistress?"
Matthew's hand tightened on his dagger, and Pierre moved to stand more squarely between us and the door.
"Father Hubbard wants to see you," the smaller vampire said, looking with contempt at the weapon in Matthew's hand. "Come when the clock's toll 7.
"Tell Hubbard I'll be there when it's convenient," said Matthew with a touch of venom.
"Not just you," the taller boy said.
"I haven't seen Kit," Matthew said with a touch of impatience. "If he's in trouble, your master has a better idea where to look for him than I do, Corner." It was an apt name for the boy. His adolescent frame was all angles and points.
"Marlowe's been with Father Hubbard all day."
Corner's tone dripped with boredom.
"Has he?"
Matthew said, eyes sharp.
"Yes. Father Hubbard wants the witch," Corner's companion said.
"I see."
Matthew's voice went flat. There was a blur of black and silver, and his polished dagger was quivering, point first, in the door jamb near Corner's eye. Matthew strolled in their direction. Both vampires took an involuntary step back.
"Thank you for the message, Leonard."
He nudged the door closed with his foot. Pierre and Matthew exchanged a long, silent look while adolescent vampire feet racketed down the stairs.
"Hancock and Gallowglass," ordered Matthew.
"At once."
Pierre whirled out of the room, narrowly avoiding Francoise. She pulled the dagger from the doorframe.
"We had visitors," Matthew explained before she could complain about the state of the woodwork.
"What is this about, Matthew?" I asked.
"You and I are going to meet an old friend."
His voice remained ominously even. I eyed the dagger, which was now lying on the table. "Is this old friend a vampire?"
"Wine, Francoise."
Matthew grabbed at a few sheets of paper, disordering my carefully arranged piles. I muffled a protest as he picked up one of my quills and wrote with furious speed. He hadn't looked at me since the knock on the door.
"There is fresh blood from the butcher. Perhaps you should..."
Matthew looked up, his mouth compressed into a thin line. Francoise poured him a large goblet of wine without further protest. When she was finished, he handed her two letters.
"Take this to the Earl of Northumberland at Russell House. The other goes to Raleigh. He'll be at Whitehall."
Francoise went immediately, and Matthew strode to the window, staring up the street. His hair was tangled in his high linen collar, and I had a sudden urge to put it to rights for him. But the set of his shoulders warned me that he wouldn't welcome such a proprietary gesture.
"Father Hubbard?" I reminded him.
But Matthew's mind was elsewhere.
"You're going to get yourself killed," he said roughly, his back still turned. "Isabeau warned me you have no instinct for self-preservation. How many times does something like this have to happen before you develop one?"
"What have I done now?"
"You wanted to be seen, Diana," he said harshly. "Well, you were."
"Stop looking out the window. I'm tired of talking to the back of your head."
I spoke quietly, though I wanted to throttle him.
"Who is Father Hubbard?"
"Andrew Hubbard is a vampire. He rules London."
"What do you mean, he rules London? Do all the vampires in the city obey him?"
In the 21st century, London's vampires were renowned for their strong allegiance to the pack, their nocturnal habits, and their loyalty, or so I'd heard from other witches. Not as flamboyant as the vampires in Paris, Venice, or Istanbul,
nor as bloodthirsty as those in Moscow, New York, and Beijing, London vampires were a well-organized bunch.
Not just the vampires, witches and demons too.
Matthew turned on me, his eyes cold.
Andrew Hubbard is a former priest, one with a poor education and enough grasp of theology to cause trouble. He became a vampire when the plague first came to London. It had killed nearly half the city by 1349. Hubbard survived the first wave of the epidemic, caring for the sick and burying the dead, but in time he succumbed.
And someone saved him by making him a vampire?
Yes, though I've never been able to find out who it was. There are plenty of legends, though, most about his supposedly divine resurrection. When he was certain he was going to die, people say he dug a grave for himself in the churchyard and climbed into it to wait for God. Hours later, Hubbard rose and walked out among the living. Matthew paused. I don't believe he's been entirely sane since.
Hubbard gathers up lost souls, Matthew continued. There were too many to count in those days. He took them in. Orphans, widows, men who had lost entire families in a single week. Those who fell ill he made into vampires, re-baptizing them and ensuring they had homes, food, and jobs. Hubbard considers them his children.
Even the witches and demons?
Yes, said Matthew tersely. He takes them through a ritual of adoption, but it's nothing at all like the one Philippe performed. Hubbard tastes their blood. He claims it reveals the content of their souls and provides proof that God has entrusted them to his care.
It reveals their secrets to him, too, I said slowly. Matthew nodded. No wonder he wanted me to stay far away from this Father Hubbard. If a vampire tasted my blood, he would know about the baby, and who his father was.
Philippe and Hubbard reached an agreement that exempted the de Clermonts from his family rituals and obligations. I probably should have told him you were my wife before we entered the city.
But you chose not to, I said carefully, hands clenching. Now I knew why Galloglass had requested that we dock somewhere other than at the foot of Water Lane. Philippe was right. There were times when Matthew behaved like an idiot, or the most arrogant man alive.
Hubbard stays out of my way and I stay out of his. As soon as he knows you're a de Clermont, he'll leave you alone too.
Matthew spotted something in the street below.
Thank God.
Heavy footsteps sounded on the stairs, and a minute later, Galloglass and Hancock stood in our parlor.
It took you too long enough. And hello to you, Matthew, Galloglass said. So Hubbard's demanded an audience at last. And before you suggest it, don't even think about tweaking his nose by leaving Auntie here. Whatever the plan, she's going to.
Uncharacteristically, Matthew ran his hand through his hair from back to front.
Shit! Hancock said, watching the progress of Matthew's fingers.
Making his hair stand up like a coxcomb was apparently another of Matthew's tells, one that meant his creative well of evasion and half-truths had run dry.
Your only plan was to avoid Hubbard. You don't have another. We've never been certain if you were a brave man or a fool, de Clermont, but I think this might decide the question, and not in your favor.
I planned to take Diana to Hubbard on Monday. After she'd been in the city for 10 days, Galloglass observed. There was no need for haste. Diana is a de Clermont. Besides, we aren't in the city, Matthew said quickly.
At my look of confusion, he continued.
The Blackfriars isn't really part of London. I'm not going into Hubbard's den and arguing the geography of the city with him again, Galloglass said, slapping his gloves against his thigh. He didn't agree when you made this argument so you could station the Brotherhood in the Tower after we arrived to help the Lancastrians in 1485, and he's not going to agree to it now.
Let's not keep him waiting, said Hancock. We have plenty of time.
Matthew's tone was dismissive.
You never have understood the tides, Matthew. I assume we're going by water, since you think the Thames isn't really part of the city either. If so, we may already be too late. Let's move.
Galloglass jerked his thumb in the direction of the front door. Pierre was waiting for us there, tugging black leather over his hands.
He'd swapped his usual brown cloak for a black one that was far too long to be fashionable. A silver device covered his right arm, a snake circling a cross with a crescent moon tucked into the upper quadrant. This was Philippe's crest, distinct from Matthew's only by the absence of the star in fleur-de-lis. Once Galloglass and Pierre were similarly outfitted, Françoise settled a matching cloak on Matthew's shoulders. Its heavy folds swept the floor, making him look taller and even more imposing. When the four of them stood together, it was an intimidating sight, one that provided a plausible inspiration for every human account of darkly cloaked vampires ever written. At the bottom of Water Lane, Galloglass surveyed the available vessels.
"That one might hold us all," he said, pointing to a long rowboat and letting out an ear-piercing whistle.
When the man standing by it asked where we were headed, the vampire embarked on a complicated set of instructions regarding our route, which of the city's many docks we were going to put into, and who would be rowing. After Galloglass growled at him, the poor man huddled near the lamp in the bow of his boat and looked nervously over his shoulder every now and again. "Frightening every boatman we meet is not going to improve relations with our neighbors," I commented as Matthew boarded, looking pointedly at the brewery next door. Hancock picked me up without ceremony and handed me off to my husband. Matthew's arm tightened around me as the boat shot out into the river. Even the waterman gasped at the speed.
"There's no need to draw attention to ourselves, Galloglass," Matthew said sharply. "Do you want to row and I'll keep your wife warm?" When Matthew didn't reply, Galloglass shook his head. "Thought not."
The soft glow of lamps from London Bridge penetrated the gloom ahead of us, and the crashing sound of fast-moving water became louder with each stroke that Galloglass took. Matthew eyed the shoreline.
"Put in at the old Swan Stairs. I want to be back in this boat and headed upstream before the tide turns."
"Quiet." Hancock's whisper had a sharp edge. "We're supposed to be sneaking up on Hubbard. We might as well have proceeded down Cheapside with trumpets and banners for all the noise you're making." Galloglass turned back toward the stern and gave two powerful pulls with his left hand. A few more pulls put us at the landing. Nothing more than a rickety set of steps, really, attached to some listing pylons, where several men waited. The boatman waved them off with a few terse words, hopping out of the boat as soon as he was able. We climbed to street level and wended through twisting lanes in silence, darting between houses and across small gardens. The vampires moved with the stealth of cats. I moved less surely, stumbling on loose stones and stepping into waterlogged potholes. At last we turned into a broad street. Laughter came from the far end, and light spilled into the street from wide windows. I rubbed my hands together, drawn to the warmth. Perhaps that was our destination. Perhaps this would be simple, and we could meet Andrew Hubbard, show him my wedding ring, and return home. Matthew led us across the street instead, and into a desolate churchyard whose gravestones tipped toward each other, as if the dead sought comfort from one another. Pierre had a solid metal ring full of keys, and Galloglass fitted one into the lock of the door next to the bell tower. We walked through the ramshackle nave, and passed through a wooden door to the left of the altar. Narrow stone stairs plunged down into the darkness. With my limited warm-blooded sight, there was no way to keep my bearings as we twisted and turned through narrow passageways and crossed expanses that smelled of wine, must, and human decay. The experience was straight out of the tales that humans told to discourage people from lingering in church basements and graveyards. We moved deeper into a warren of tunnels and subterranean rooms and entered a dimly lit crypt. Hollow eyes stared out from the heaped skulls in a small ossuary. A vibration in the stone floor and the muffled sound of bells indicated that somewhere above us the clocks were striking 7. Matthew hurried us along into another tunnel that showed a soft glow in the distance. At the end, we stepped into a cellar used to store wine unloaded from ships on the Thames. A few barrels stood by the walls, and the fresher scent of sawdust competed with the smell of old wine. I spied the source of the former aromas. Neatly stacked coffins, arranged by size from long boxes capable of holding galloglass to minuscule caskets for infants. Shadows moved and flickered in the deep corners, and in the center of the room, a ritual of some kind was taking place amid a throng of creatures.
"My blood is yours, Father Hubbard."
The man who spoke was frightened.
"I give it willingly, that you might know my heart and number me among your family."
There was silence, a cry of pain. Then the air filled with a taut sense of expectation.
"I accept your gift, James, and promise to protect you as my child," a rough voice answered. "In exchange, you will honor me as your father. Greet your brothers and sisters."
Amid the hubbub of welcome, my skin registered a sensation of ice.
"You're late."
The rumble of sound cut through the chatter and set the hair on my neck prickling.
"And traveling with a full retinue, I see."
"That's impossible since we have no appointment."
Matthew gripped my elbow as dozens of glances nudged, tingled, and chilled my skin. Soft steps approached, circled. A tall, thin man appeared directly before me. I met his stare without flinching, knowing better than to show fear to a vampire. Hubbard's eyes were deep set under a heavy brow bone, with veins of blue, green, and brown radiating through the slate-colored iris. The vampire's eyes were the only colorful thing about him. Otherwise, he was preternaturally pale, with white blonde hair cropped close to his skull, nearly invisible eyebrows and lashes, and a wide horizontal slash of lips set in a clean-shaven face. His long black coat, which looked like a cross between a scholar's gown and a cleric's cassock, accentuated his cadaverous build. There was no mistaking the strength in his broad, slightly stooped shoulders, but the rest of him was practically skeletal. There was a blur of motion as blunt, powerful fingers took my chin and jerked my head to the side. In the same instant, Matthew's hand wrapped around the vampire's wrist. Hubbard's cold glance touched my neck, taking in the scar there. For once, I wished Francoise had outfitted me with the largest ruff she could find. He exhaled an icy gust smelling of cinnabar and fur before his wide mouth tightened, the edges of his lips turning from pale peach to white.
"We have a problem, Master Royden," said Hubbard. "We have several, Father Hubbard. The first is that you have your hands on something that belongs to me. If you don't remove them, I'll tear this den to pieces before sunrise. What happens afterward will make every creature in the city, demon, human, huerch, and witch, think the end of days is upon us."
Matthew's voice vibrated with fury. Creatures emerged from the shadows. I saw John Chandler, the apothecary from Cripplegate, who met my eyes defiantly. Kit was there too, standing next to another demon. When his friend's arm slid through the crook in his elbow, Kit pulled away slightly.
"Hello, Kit," Matthew said, his voice dead. "I thought you would have run off and hidden by now."
Hubbard held my chin for a few moments longer, pulling my head back until I faced him once more. My anger at Kit and the witch who had betrayed us must have shown, and he shook his head in warning.
"Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart," he murmured, releasing me.
Hubbard's eyes swept the room.
"Leave us."
Matthew's hands cupped my face, and his fingers smoothed the skin of my chin to erase Hubbard's scent.
"Go with Galloglass. I'll see you shortly."
"She stays," Hubbard said.
Matthew's muscles twitched. He wasn't used to being countermanded. After a considerable pause, he ordered his friends and family to wait outside. Hancock was the only one not to obey immediately.
"Your father says a wise man can see more from the bottom of a well than a fool can from a mountaintop. Let's hope he's right," Hancock muttered, "because this is one hell of a hole you put us in tonight."
With one last look, he followed Galloglass and Pierre through a break in the far wall. A heavy door closed, and there was silence. The three of us stood so close that I could hear the next soft expulsion of air from Matthew's lungs. As for Hubbard, I wondered if the plague had done more than drive him mad. His skin was waxy rather than porcelain, as though he still suffered the lingering effect of illness.
"May I remind you, Monsieur de Clermont, you are here under my sufferance."
Hubbard sat in the chamber's grand, solitary chair.
"Even though you represent the congregation, I permit your presence in London because your father demands it. But you have flouted our customs and allow your wife to enter the city without introducing her to me and my flock. And then there is the matter of your knights."
"Most of the knights who accompanied me have lived in this city longer than you have, Andrew. When you insisted they join your flock or leave the city boundaries, they resettled outside the walls. You and my father agreed that the de Clermonts would not bring more of the Brotherhood into the city. I haven't."
"And you think my children care about these subtleties? I saw the rings they wore and the devices on their cloaks."
Hubbard leaned forward, his eyes menacing.
"I was led to believe you were halfway to Scotland. Why are you still here?"
"Perhaps you don't pay your informants enough," Matthew suggested. "Kit's very short on funds these days."
"I don't buy love and loyalty, nor do I resort to intimidation and torment to have my way."
"Christopher willingly does what I ask, like all godly children do when they love their father."
"Kit has too many masters to be faithful to any one of them."
"Couldn't the same be said of you?"
After delivering his challenge to Matthew, Hubbard turned to me and deliberately drank in my scent. He made a soft, sorrowful sound.
"But let us speak of your marriage. Some of my children believe that relationships between a witch and a werech are abhorrent, but the congregation and its covenant are no more welcome in my city than are your father's vengeful knights. Both interfere with God's wish that we live as one family. Also, your wife is a time spinner," Hubbard said. "I do not approve of time spinners, for they tempt men and women with ideas that do not belong here."
"Ideas like choice and freedom of thought," I interjected.
"What are you afraid
next?" Hubbard interrupted, his focus still on Matthew as though I were invisible. "There is the matter of your feeding on her." His eyes moved to the scar that Matthew had left on my neck.
"When the witches discover it, they will demand an inquiry. If your wife is found guilty of willingly offering her blood to a vampire, she will be shunned and cast out of London. If you are found guilty of taking it without her consent, you will be put to death."
"So much for family sentiment," I muttered.
"Diana," Matthew warned.
Hubbard tented his fingers and studied Matthew once more.
"And finally, she's breeding. Will the child's father come looking for her?"
That brought my responses to a halt. Hubbard had not yet ferreted out our biggest secret, that Matthew was the father of my child. I fought down the panic. Think and stay alive. Maybe Philippe's advice would get us out of this predicament.
"No," Matthew said shortly. "So the father is dead." "From natural causes or by your hand," Hubbard said, casting a long look at Matthew. "In that case, the witch's child will be brought into my flock when it's born. His mother will become one of my children now."
"No," Matthew repeated, "she will not."
"How long do you imagine the two of you will survive outside London, when the rest of the congregation hears of these offences?"
Hubbard shook his head.
"Your wife will be safe here, so long as she is a member of my family and there is no more sharing of blood between you."
"You will not put Diana through that perverted ceremony. Tell your children that she belongs to you if you must, but you will not take her blood or that of her child."
"I will not lie to the souls in my care." "Why is it, my son, that secrets and war are the only responses you have when God puts a challenge before you? They only lead to destruction."
Hubbard's throat worked with emotion.
God reserves salvation for those who believe in something greater than themselves.
Before Matthew could shoot back a reply, I put my hand on his arm to quiet him.
Excuse me, Father Hubbard, I said. If I understand correctly, the de Clermonts are exempt from your governance?
That is correct, Mistress Royden. But you are not a de Clermont. You are merely married to one.
Wrong, I retorted, keeping my husband's sleeve in a tight grip. I am Philippe de Clermont's blood-sworn daughter, as well as Matthew's wife. I'm a de Clermont twice over, and neither I nor my child will ever call you father.
Andrew Hubbard looked stunned.
As I heaped silent blessings on Philippe for always staying three steps ahead of the rest of us, Matthew's shoulders finally relaxed. Though far away in France, his father had ensured our safety once more.
Check, if you like. Philippe marked my forehead here, I said, touching the spot between my brows where my witch's third eye was located. It was slumbering at the moment, unconcerned with vampires.
I believe you, Mistress Royden, Hubbard said finally. No one would have the temerity to lie about such a thing in a house of God.
Perhaps you can help me, then. I'm in London to seek help with some finer points of magic and witchcraft. Who among your children would you recommend for the task?
My question erased Matthew's grin. Diana, he growled.
My father would be very pleased if you could assist me, I said, calmly ignoring him.
And what form would this pleasure take?
Andrew Hubbard was a Renaissance prince, too, and interested in gaining whatever strategic advantage he could. First, my father would be pleased to hear about our quiet hours at home on the eve of the New Year, I said, meeting his eyes. Everything else I tell him in my next letter will depend on the witch you send to the Heart and Crown. Hubbard considered my request.
I will discuss your needs with my children and decide who might best serve you.
Whoever he sends will be a spy, Matthew warned.
You're a spy, too, I pointed out. I'm tired. I want to go home.
Our business here is done, Hubbard. I trust that Diana, like all de Clermonts, is in London with your approval.
Matthew turned to leave without waiting for an answer.
Even the de Clermonts must be careful in the city, Hubbard called after us. See that you remember it, Mistress Royden.
Matthew and Galloglass spoke in low voices on our row home, but I was silent. I refused help getting out of the boat and began the climb up Water Lane without waiting for them. Even so, Pierre was ahead of me by the time I reached the passage into the Heart and Crown, and Matthew was at my elbow. Inside, Walter and Henry were waiting for us. They shot to their feet.
Thank God, Walter said.
We came as soon as we heard that you were in need. George is sick abed, and neither Kit nor Tom could be found, Henry explained,
eyes darting anxiously between me and Matthew.
I'm sorry to have called you. My alarm was premature, Matthew said, his cloak swirling around his feet as he took it from his shoulders.
If it concerns the order, Walter began, eyeing the cloak.
It doesn't, Matthew assured him.
It concerns me, I said. And before you come up with some other disastrous scheme, understand this. The witches are my concern. Matthew is being watched, and not just by Andrew Hubbard.
He's used to it, Galloglass said gruffly. Pay the gawpers no mind, Auntie.
I need to find my own teacher, Matthew, I said. My hand fluttered down to where the point of my bodice covered the top of my belly. No witch is going to part with her secrets so long as any of you are involved. Everyone who enters this house is either a wech, a philosopher, or a spy. Which means, in the eyes of my people, that any one of you could turn us into the authorities. Beric may seem far away, but the panic is spreading. Matthew's gaze was frosty, but at least he was listening. If you order a witch here, one will come. Matthew Royden always gets his way. But instead of help, I'll get another performance like the one Widow Beaton gave. That's not what I need.
You need Hubbard's help even less, Hancock said sourly.
We don't have much time, I reminded Matthew.
Hubbard didn't know that the baby was Matthew's, and Hancock and Galloglass hadn't perceived the changes to my scent yet. But this evening's events had driven home our precarious position.
All right, Diana. We'll leave the witches to you. But no lies, Matthew said, and no secrets either. One of the people in this room has to know where you are at all times.
Matthew, you cannot, Walter protested.
I trust my wife's judgment, Matthew said firmly.
That's what Philippe says about Granny, Galloglass muttered under his breath. Just before all hell breaks loose.
Chapter 19.
If this is what hell looks like, Matthew murmured the week after our encounter with Hubbard, Galloglass is going to be sadly disappointed. There was, in truth, very little fire and brimstone about the 14-year-old witch standing before us in the parlor. Hush, I said, mindful of how sensitive a child that age could be.
Did Father Hubbard explain why you're here, Annie?
Yes, mistress, Annie replied miserably. It was difficult to tell if the girl's pallor was due to her natural coloring or some combination of fear and poor nutrition.
I'm to serve you and accompany you about the city on your business.
No, that wasn't our agreement, Matthew said impatiently, his booted feet landing heavily on the wooden floor. Annie flinched.
Do you have any power or knowledge to speak of, or is Hubbard playing some joke?
I have a little skill,
Annie stammered, her pale blue eyes contrasting with her white skin.
But I need a place, and Father Hubbard said...
Oh, I can imagine what Father Hubbard said, Matthew snorted contemptuously. The look I gave him held sufficient warning that he blinked and was quiet.
Allow her a chance to explain, I told him sharply, before giving the girl an encouraging smile. Go on, Annie.
As well as serving you, Father Hubbard says I'm to take you to my aunt when she returns to London. She is at a lying-in at present, and refused to leave while the woman still had need of her.
Your aunt is a midwife as well as a witch? I asked gently.
Yes, mistress. A fine midwife and a powerful witch, Annie said proudly, straightening her spine.
When she did so, her two short skirts exposed her skinny ankles to the cold.
Andrew Hubbard outfitted his sons in warm, well-fitting clothes, but his daughters received no such consideration. I smothered my irritation. Francoise would have to get her needles out.
And how did you come to be a part of Father Hubbard's family?
My mother was not a virtuous woman, Annie murmured, twisting her hands in her thin cloak. Father Hubbard found me in the undercroft of St. Anne's Church near Aldersgate, my mother dead beside me. My aunt was newly married and soon had babies of her own. I was 6 years old. Her husband did not want me raised among his sons for fear I would corrupt them with my sinfulness. So Annie, now a teenager, had been with Hubbard for more than half her life. The thought was chilling, and the idea that a 6-year-old could corrupt anyone was beyond comprehension. But this story explained both her abject look and the girl's peculiar name, Annie Undercroft.
While Francoise gets you something to eat, I can show you where you will sleep.
I'd been up to the third floor that morning to inspect the small bed, three-legged stool, and worn chest set aside to hold the witch's belongings.
I'll help you carry your things.
Mistress?
Annie said, confused.
She brought nothing, Francoise said, casting disapproving looks at the newest member of the household.
Never mind. She'll have belongings soon enough.
I smiled at Annie, who looked uncertain. Francoise and I spent the weekend making sure that Annie was clean as a whistle, clothed and shod properly, and that she knew enough basic math to make small purchases for me. To test her, I sent her to the nearby apothecary for a penny's worth of quill pens and half a pound of sealing wax. Philippe was right.
Matthew went through office supplies at an alarming pace, and she came back promptly with change to spare.
"He wanted a shilling," Annie complained. "That wax isn't even good enough for candles, is it?"
Pierre took a shine to the girl and made it his business to elicit a rare, sweet smile from Annie whenever he could. He taught her how to play cat's cradle and volunteered to walk with her on Sunday when Matthew dropped broad hints that he would like us to be alone for a few hours.
"He won't take advantage of her," I asked Matthew as he unbuttoned my favorite item of clothing,
a sleeveless boy's jerkin made of fine black wool. I wore it with a set of skirts and a smock when we were at home.
"Pierre? Good Christ, no."
Matthew looked amused.
"It's a fair question."
Mary Sidney had not been much older when she was married off to the highest bidder.
"And I gave you a truthful answer. Pierre doesn't bed young girls."
His hand stilled after he freed the last button.
"This is a pleasant surprise. You're not wearing a corset."
"It's uncomfortable, and I'm blaming it on the baby." He lifted the jerkin away from my body with an appreciative sound.
"And he'll keep other men from bothering her?"
"Can this conversation possibly wait until later?" Matthew said, his exasperation showing. "Given the cold, they won't be gone for long."
"You're very impatient in the bedroom," I observed, sliding my hands into the neck of his shirt.
"Really?"
Matthew arched his aristocratic brows in mock disbelief, and here I thought the problem was my admirable restraint. He spent the next few hours showing me just how limitless his patience could be in an empty house on a Sunday. By the time everybody returned, we were both pleasantly exhausted and in a considerably better frame of mind. Everything returned to normal on Monday, however. Matthew was distracted and irritable as soon as the first letters arrived at dawn, and he sent his apologies to the Countess at Pembroke when it became clear that the obligations of his many jobs wouldn't allow him to accompany me to our midday meal. Mary listened without surprise as I explained the reason for Matthew's absence, blinked at Annie like a mildly curious owl, and sent her off to the kitchens in the care of Joan. We shared a delicious lunch, during which Mary offered detailed accounts of the private lives of everyone within shouting distance of the Blackfriars. Afterward, we withdrew to her laboratory with Joan and Annie to assist us.
"And how is your husband, Diana?" the Countess asked, rolling up her sleeves, her eyes fixed on the book before her.
"In good health," I said. This, I had learned, was the Elizabethan equivalent of fine.
"That is welcome news."
Mary turned and stirred something that looked noxious and smelled worse.
"Much depends on it, I fear. The Queen relies on him more than any other man in the kingdom except Lord Burleigh."
"I wish his good humor were more reliable. Matthew is mercurial these days. He's possessive one moment and ignores me as if I were a piece of furniture the next."
"Men treat their property that way."
She picked up a jug of water. "I am not his property," I said flatly.
"What you and I know, what the law says, and how Matthew himself feels are three entirely separate issues."
"They shouldn't be," I said quickly, ready to argue the point. Mary silenced me with a gentle, resigned smile.
"You and I have an easier time with our husbands than other women do, Diana. We have our books and the leisure to indulge our passions, thank God. Most do not." Mary gave everything in her beaker a final stir and decanted the contents into another glass vessel. I thought of Annie. A mother who died alone in a church cellar. An aunt who couldn't take her in because of her husband's prejudices. A life that promised little in the way of comfort or hope.
"Do you teach your female servants how to read?"
"Certainly," Mary responded promptly. "They learn to write and reckon, too. Such skills will make them more valuable to a good husband.
One who likes to earn money as well as spend it."
She beckoned to Joan, who helped her move the fragile glass bubble full of chemicals to the fire.
"Then Annie shall learn as well," I said, giving the girl a nod. She clung to the shadows, looking ghostly with her pale face and silver blonde hair.
Education would increase her confidence. She'd had a definite lilt in her step ever since haggling with Monsieur Delone over the price of sealing wax.
"She will have reason in the future to thank you for it," said Mary. Her face was serious. "We women own nothing absolutely, save what lies between our ears. Our virtue belongs first to our father and then to our husband. We dedicate our duty to our family. As soon as we share our thoughts with another, put pen to paper or thread a needle, all that we do and make belongs to someone else. So long as she has words and ideas, Annie will always possess something that is hers alone."
"If only you were a man, Mary," I said with a shake of my head.
"The Countess of Pembroke could run rings around most creatures, regardless of their sex."
"Were I a man, I would be on my estates now, or paying court to a majesty like Henry, or seeing to matters of state like Matthew. Instead, I am here in my laboratory with you. Weighing it all in the balance, I believe we are better off, even if we are sometimes put on a pedestal or mistaken for a kitchen stool."
Mary's round eyes twinkled. I laughed. "You may be right.
Had you ever been to court, you would have no doubts on this score. Come," Mary said, turning to her experiment. "Now we will wait while the primer materia is exposed to the heat. If we have done well, this is what will generate the Philosopher's Stone. Let us review the next steps of the process in hopes that the experiment will succeed."
I always lost track of time while there were alchemical manuscripts around, and I looked up, dazed, when Matthew and Henry walked into the laboratory. Mary and I had been deep in conversation about the images in a collection of alchemical texts known as Pretiosa Margarita Novella, the new pearl of great price. Was it already late afternoon?
"It can't be time to go. Not yet," I protested. "Mary has this manuscript."
"Matthew knows the book, for his brother gave it to me. Now that Matthew has a learned wife, he may regret having done so," Mary said with a laugh. "There are refreshments waiting in the sala. I'd hoped to see you both today." At this, Henry gave Mary a conspiratorial wink.
"That is kind, Mary," Matthew said, kissing me on the cheek in greeting. "Apparently you two haven't reached the vinegar stage yet. You still smell of vitriol and magnesia."
I put down the book reluctantly and washed, while Mary finished making notes of the day's work. Once we were settled in the solar, Henry could no longer curb his excitement.
"Is it time now, Mary?"
he asked the Countess, shifting in his chair.
"You have the same enthusiasm for giving presents as young William does," she replied with a laugh. "Henry and I have a gift in honor of the new year and your marriage."
But we had nothing to give them in return. I looked at Matthew, uncomfortable with this one-way exchange.
"I wish you luck, Diana, if you hope to stay ahead of Mary and Henry when it comes to gifts," he said ruefully.
"Nonsense," Mary replied. "Matthew saved my brother Philip's life and Henry's estate. No gifts can repay such debts. Do not ruin our pleasure with such talk. It's a tradition to give gifts to those newly wed, and it is New Year. What did you give the Queen, Matthew?"
"After she sent poor King James another clock to remind him to bide his time quietly, I considered giving her a crystal hourglass. I thought it might be a useful reminder of her relative mortality," he said dryly. Henry looked at him with horror.
"No, not really."
"It was an idle thought in a moment of frustration," Matthew reassured him. "I gave her a covered cup, of course, like everyone else."
"Don't forget our gift, Henry," said Mary, now equally impatient. Henry drew out a velvet pouch and presented it to me. I fumbled with the strings and finally drew out a heavy gold locket on an equally weighty chain. Its face was golden filigree studded with rubies and diamonds, Matthew's moon and star in its center. I flipped the locket over, gasping at the brilliant enamel work with its flowers and scrolling vines. Carefully, I opened the clasp at the bottom, and a miniature rendering of Matthew looked up at me. "Master Hilliard made the preliminary sketches when he was here.
With the holidays, he was so busy that his assistant Isaac had to help with the painting, Mary explained.
I cupped the miniature in my hand, tilting it this way and that. Matthew was painted as he looked at home when he was working late at night in his study off the bedroom. His shirt open at the neck and trimmed with lace, he met the viewer's gaze with a lift of his right eyebrow in a familiar combination of seriousness and mocking humor. Black hair was swept back from his forehead in its typically disordered fashion, and the long fingers of his left hand held a locket. It was a surprisingly frank and erotic image for the time.
"Is it to your liking?"
Henry asked. "I love it," I said, unable to stop staring at my new treasure. Isaac is rather more daring in his composition than his master is, but when I told him it was a wedding gift, he convinced me that such a locket would remain a wife's special secret and could reveal the private man rather than the public. Mary looked over my shoulder. "It is a good likeness, but I do wish Master Hilliard would learn how to better capture a person's chin." "It's perfect, and I will treasure it always."
"This one is for you,"
Henry said, handing Matthew an identical bag.
"Hilliard felt you might show it to others and wear it at court, so it is somewhat more, circumspect."
"Is that the locket Matthew is holding in my miniature?" I said, pointing to the distinctive milky stone set in a simple gold frame.
"I believe so," Matthew said softly. "Is it a moonstone, Henry?" "An ancient specimen," Henry said proudly. "It was among my curiosities, and I wanted you to have it. The intaglio is of the goddess Diana, you see."
The miniature within was more respectable, but startling nonetheless in its informality. I was wearing the russet gown trimmed with black velvet. A delicate ruff framed my face without covering the shining pearls at my throat. But it was the arrangement of my hair that signaled that this was an intimate gift appropriate for a new husband. It flowed freely over my shoulders and down my back in a wild riot of red-gold curls.
"The blue background emphasizes Diana's eyes, and the set of her mouth is so true to life."
Matthew, too, was overwhelmed by the gift. "I had a frame made," Mary said, gesturing at Joan, "to display them when they're not being worn." It was more a shallow box, with two oval niches lined in black velvet. The two miniatures fit perfectly inside and gave the effect of a pair of portraits.
"It was thoughtful of Mary and Henry to give us such a gift," Matthew said later when we were back at the Heart and Crown.
He slid his arms around me from behind and laced his hands over my belly.
"I haven't even had time to take your picture. I never imagined my first likeness of you would be by Nicholas Hilliard."
"The portraits are beautiful," I said, covering his hands with mine.
"But..."
Matthew drew back and tilted his head. "Miniatures by Nicholas Hilliard are sought after, Matthew. These won't disappear when we do. And they're so exquisite, I couldn't bear to destroy them before we go." Time was like my ruff. It started out as a smooth, flat, tightly woven fabric. Then it was twisted and cut and made to double back on itself. We keep touching the past in ways that are bound to leave smudges on the present.
"Maybe that's what we're supposed to be doing," Matthew suggested. "Perhaps the future depends on it."
"I don't see how."
"Not now. But it is possible that we'll look back one day and discover that it was the miniatures that made all the difference."
He smiled. "Imagine what finding Ashmole 782 would do then." I looked up at him. Seeing Mary's illuminated alchemical books had brought the mysterious volume and our frustrated search for it vividly back to mind. George had no luck finding it in Oxford, but it must be somewhere in England. Ashmole acquired our manuscript from somebody. Rather than looking for the manuscript, we should look for the person who sold it to him.
"These days there's a steady traffic in manuscripts. Ashmole 782 could be anywhere."
"Or it could be right here," I insisted.
You may be right, Matthew agreed. But I could tell that his mind was on more immediate concerns than our elusive tome. I'll send George out to make inquiries among the booksellers.
All thoughts of Ashmole 782 fled the next morning, however, when a note arrived from Annie's aunt, the prosperous midwife. She was back in London.
"The witch will not come to the house of a notorious wech and spy," Matthew reported after he had read its contents. "Her husband objects to the plan for fear it will ruin his reputation. We are to go to her house near St. James Church on Garlic Hill."
When I didn't react, Matthew scowled and continued. "It's on the other side of town, within spitting distance of Andrew Hubbard's den."
"You are a vampire," I reminded him. "She is a witch. We aren't supposed to mix. This witch's husband is right to be cautious."
Matthew insisted on accompanying Annie and me across town anyway. The area surrounding St. James Church was far more prosperous than the Blackfriars, with spacious, well-kept streets, large houses, busy shops, and a tidy churchyard. Annie led us into an alley across from the church. Though dark, it was neat as a pin.
"There, Master Royden," the girl said.
She directed Matthew's attention to the sign with a windmill on it before darting ahead with Pierre to alert the household to our arrival.
"You don't have to stay," I told Matthew. This visit was nerve-wracking enough without him hovering and glowering.
"I'm not going anywhere," he replied grimly.
We were met at the door by a round-faced woman with a snub nose, a gentle chin, and rich brown hair and eyes. Her face was serene, although her eyes snapped with irritation. She had stopped Pierre in his tracks. Only Annie had been admitted to the house and stood to one side in the doorway, looking dismayed at the impasse.
I also stopped in my tracks, my mouth open in surprise. Annie's aunt was the spitting image of Sophie Norman, the young demon to whom we'd waved goodbye at the Bishop House in Madison.
"Dieu," Matthew murmured, looking down at me in amazement.
"My aunt, Susanna Norman," Annie whispered.
Our reaction had unsettled her.
"She says..."
"Susanna Norman?" I asked, unable to take my eyes from her face. Her name and strong resemblance to Sophie couldn't be a coincidence.
"As my niece said, you appear to be out of your element, Mistress Royden," Mistress Norman said. "And you are not welcome here, where?"
"Mistress Norman," Matthew said with a bow.
"Did you not get my letter? My husband wants nothing to do with you."
Two boys shot out of the door.
"Geoffrey! John!"
"Is this him?" the elder said. He studied Matthew with interest, then turned his attention on me. The child had power. Though he was still on the brink of adolescence, his abilities could already be felt in the crackle of undisciplined magic that surrounded him.
"Use the talents God gave you, Geoffrey, and don't ask idle questions."
The witch looked at me appraisingly.
"You certainly made Father Hubbard sit up and take notice. Very well, come inside."
When we moved to do so, Susanna held up her hand.
"Not you, Ware. My business is with your wife. The Golden Gosling has decent wine if you're determined to remain nearby. But it would be better for all concerned if you were to let your man see Mistress Royden home."
"Thank you for the advice, Mistress. I'm sure I'll find something satisfactory at the inn. Pierre will wait in the courtyard. He doesn't mind the cold." Matthew gave her a wolfish smile. Susanna looked sour and turned smartly.
"Come along, Geoffrey,"
she called over her shoulder. Geoffrey commandeered his younger brother, cast one more interested glance at Matthew, and followed.
"When you're ready, Mistress Royden."
"I can't believe it," I whispered as soon as the Normans were out of sight. "She has to be Sophie's great-grandmother many times over."
"Sophie must be descended through either Geoffrey or John."
Matthew pulled thoughtfully on his chin. "One of those boys is the missing link in our chain of circumstances that leads from Kit and the silver chess piece to the Norman family and on to North Carolina."
"The future really is taking care of itself," I said.
"I thought it would. As for the present, Pierre will be right here and I'll be close by."
The fine lines around his eyes deepened.
He didn't want to be more than 6 inches away from me at the best of times.
I'm not sure how long this will take, I said, squeezing his arm.
It doesn't matter, Matthew assured me, brushing my lips with his. Stay as long as you need.